Welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of history. My name is Alex Hokuli. I'm in São Paulo, as usual, and it is Thursday, the 15th of February. So the episode that came out last week, you'll have heard that we spoke to Vedi Hadiz about Indonesia's history, its social formation, and look forward to the election, which just happened yesterday. So now this is going to be the second episode we do on Indonesia and its elections. You might ask yourself why, but as the title of this episode has it, and the previous one too, it's the biggest country that no one actually really talks about. It's the world's fourth largest country by population. It's in the top 10 economies by purchasing power parity. And then yesterday, Indonesia went to the polls on the 14th of February, and this is the world's third largest democracy. And it stages what is, I think, the world's biggest single day general election. And it's also a very young country. Young people made up the majority of voters, 55% of them aged between 17 and 40. Okay, so who is the winner? Well, as you heard on last week's podcast, it was already pretty clear what the outcome would be. It was Prabowo Subianto, excuse me for the pronunciation. So what's been the response to this? I think it's kind of interesting. Winter is coming, exclaimed The Guardian in response. Never want to miss an opportunity for some cheap pop culture reference, which is completely irrelevant to the place, but whatever, you know, there we go. CNN said, ex-army strongman leader claims victory. The BBC said, what can Indonesia expect from its new strongman leader? So it's kind of a clear theme there. And as one kind of popular tweet had it, as expected, Prabowo is winning. Welcome to Indonesia's dark age. Oh, and fuck Jokowi. There's a lot of stuff to be explained there, I'm very happy to have someone who will be able to explain to us in depth what exactly is going on in Indonesia and place it in its historical context. Indeed, a country which seems to be keen on erasing its own historical context, but we're going to come on to that. Michael Van, delighted to have you. For those of you who don't know him, he's a professor of history at Sacramento State University and the author of The Great Hanoi Rat Hunt, Empire, Disease, and Modernity in French Colonial Vietnam, and that came out back in 2019. Mike, welcome.
Hey, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I've been a fan of you guys for a while, and also got to have you guys on the New Books Network a few years ago, and that was a fun chat.
No, it's very belated return invite, I think, here. to get stuck into it, you mentioned you were doing some grieving, drinking, or I'm not sure exactly what you called it in response to Indonesia's election results. So let's start with the emotional aspect. What prompted that?
Yeah, I was self-medicating some emotional trauma at the election results. Those of us who are Indonesia watchers and Indonesia lovers, I mean, most Indonesians are just totally captivated by the place for all the cliche reasons, which we won't go into, but there's a fantastic list of things.
Well, go into the cliche reasons. I think it's worth it because people aren't familiar with.
Well, it's stunningly gorgeous. And by the way, you guys nailed it with the title of the last episode. It is the largest country in the world that nobody talks about. And as someone who's been working on Indonesia since I was an undergraduate, actually. And it was my discovery of Indonesia is why I became a historian and wanted to become a historian in high school because it's an incredible place. I mean, so, you know, all the cliches about just the incredible beauty of natural beauty of the place, the incredible cultural diversity, well over 350 different languages, not dialects, but languages. Everyone speaks Bahasa Indonesia as a lingua franca, but that's for most people not a language that they speak at home. They speak Javanese or Bahasa Madura or Balinese or what have you. The natural beauty, the diversity of culture, the fascinating history. I mean, that's what got me into it was actually as a high schooler seeing the Year of Living Dangerously. And as a 16-year-old, I'm like, what is this place? I want to learn more about this. Mm. So there's just so many draws. And it's, you know, just incredible. But there's also these great cliches that we're not supposed to talk about, like the Year of Living Dangerously, and never mention shadow puppets as a metaphor. Don't mention volcanoes. You know, journalists always have these stock phrases, like you'll always see, you know, they'll reference, say, Prabowo, the president-elect, and they'll, journalists will say, well, many Indonesians go by one name, and which is quite common. But anyway, it's just, I think, one of the most fascinating places, and also so politically important over the course of the 20th century, and economically important throughout several centuries of history. I would argue the origins of capitalism lie in the Dutch East India Company and the spice trade, and that's what the Dutch were trying to get to, those spices, and that created the need for stock exchanges and all the financial mechanisms that we know today. So anyway, I'm a big promoter of Indonesia and the study thereof.
No, great. I mean, and I think it's worth, yeah, as I say, it's worth underlining that, just because it does get kind of strangely brushed aside in kind of global pictures of everywhere, right? And many smaller countries have a much larger, more important profile than Indonesia does. So I've always been curious as to why that is, and kind of taken a while to get around to actually doing an episode or several episodes on the country. But anyway, yeah, I figured we'd take the opportunity.
I think part of that may also be they weren't colonized by the right country to get on the map. You know, the Netherlands doesn't quite have the same footprint in the academy. Many of the first historians, the archives are going to be in Dutch, and so much post-colonial research follows the old colonial flags. You have to learn French to do Vietnamese history or a good chunk of Africa. And so that's kind of marginalized. There has not been a major Indonesian diaspora, as with, say, the Philippines or Vietnam, what have you. And also, I think that something I think we're going to talk about, I think that the Suharto regime was very good at sort of pulling Indonesia away from the spotlight after it had been in the spotlight under the nationalist president and populist president Sukarno.
I want to kind of start by the most recent events. So start with the election itself. So Prabowo, as you pointed out to me, that, you know, he's ran in 2014 and 2019 again. And in those campaign videos, he comes off as, well, a military authoritarian, as he is. And in his most recent kind of campaign videos and the persona he's tried to bring to the campaign, he's like this kind of cuddly, maybe a bit populist grandpa. So how has he affected this, and who is he really?
Yeah, this is one of the more amazing political reinventions of a candidate. I mean, so I was looking at old campaign footage from 2014, and he's literally a man on horseback. I mean, he was a decorated officer, and looking at some younger photos of him, I mean, was fit the part. I mean, he's now sort of chunky as many of us get as we get older. he was, Donald Trump's vision of what a general should look like, you know, this strong, powerful guy. And and so in these campaigns in 2014, and I think he brought the horses back in 2019, but he's literally a man on horseback with some sort of fascist looking imagery. And there was even a campaign video that came out in 2014 that is just absolutely appalling. And I urge all the listeners to Google it, Prabowo 2014 campaign video, where they had a handful of Indonesian pop stars singing to the music from We Will Rock You, but singing Prabowo Hatta, his name and his vice presidential running mate's name. And it is Nazi imagery. One of the pop stars has an SS style uniform on, and so that's the guy that we have been thinking of in terms of Prabowo for decades now. And this is in his 21st century career, right? I mean, his 20th century career is involves an extensive military resume, which we can talk about. And now this reinvention for this campaign, and it started about a year ago, and he is presented literally as this cuddly grandpa. The Indonesians are using the slang word gemoy, for it literally means cuddly, like I think the connotations are like, it's so cute, you just want to squeeze his little cheeks, right? And he's been appearing not on horseback, but at these rallies that are like music parties with like dangdut, which is this, dangdut is this like popular kind of folk pop music. It's a little risque. It's got some Indian Ocean rhythms. I don't know quite how to describe it, but he'd be dancing and dancing in a really weird, awkward manner. Not as awkward as Donald Trump's dance, where he's doing the things with the ghosts in his hands, but this sort of old grandpa dance where he's like kind of doing like Javanese kind of like folk dance moves, and not in uniform, in a casual shirt, and real man of the people. And this took off on Instagram and especially TikTok, and won over this like key voting demographic that you mentioned, the stats on how many Indonesian voters are below 30 years of age. And he won them over. And it's just, it's mind blowing. I think that folks of my generation, I'm in my mid 50s, and who remember the 20th century, and so folks in their 50s and 40s are much more nervous about this guy because they remember previous elections. And now he's this cuddly grandpa. And then, you know, he lost to the current president, Jokowi, twice, when they were both running for president in 2014 and then again in 2019. And when he lost in 2019, he refused to concede. And he had his thugs, Preman. Preman is a gangster. If you've seen The Act of Killing, the incredible Josh and Oppenheimer film, it's the Premans are the guys that go out and do the killing, and he profiles the Preman, who are these like they're racketeers who have political links in Indonesian society. Anyway, he unleashed Premans in the capital, and there were deadly riots for a couple of days. But now we've got this cuddly guy that is and the image they're using is again not Prabowo on horseback, but AI generated cartoons of him looking like he's just looking so gemoy, you just want to pinch his little cheeks.
I mean, it is remarkable. I mean, even just you read the basic biography and his implication in kidnappings and of pro-democracy demonstrators at the end of the 90s and things like this. I mean, I find it especially shocking because, I mean, I'm looking at this from a perspective from Brazil, where there was also military dictatorship over a similar sort of period, where there was the military back in power, you know, either directly or as it was, you know, through Bolsonaro kind of indirectly, but getting a lot of military people in government and in the kind of civilian arms of the state, but no one would have been into them for being cuddly. Like that would have been several steps too far in terms of trying to re-ennoble the image of the Brazilian military. So I find it quite shocking, but I also have this, you know, the images that I have of Indonesia are also like things like from The Act of Killing, which is to say quite very limited, but you have those images of like the Pancasila youth of, you know, kind of a paramilitary youth group, which are like 3 million strong or something like that. And with imagery, which is like very, not just, it's not the kind of, you know, old stand-up kind of military kind of honor or whatever. Like that's not the image that is conveyed. It's much more aggressive, sort of fascistic image that's conveyed. And so I don't know enough about Indonesia to really cast too much judgment on it. But looking at it from afar and just looking at a few kind of images, it's like, wow, this is something which is very normalized, it seems.
The fascistic aesthetic is incredibly normalized. You know, that campaign ad using the Nazi imagery didn't raise too many eyebrows in Indonesia. It was internationally where people were appalled. And I've got a slide in one of my lectures that I give on Indonesian history, talking about recent politics. And it's a picture I took when I was working at a university in Central Java, in Yogyakarta, at University of Tuscaloosa Jamada, and it's a vendor in front of the Sultan's Palace, and he's selling posters. There's a bunch of posters on the side there, and you've got the Beatles, and you've got One Direction, and then you got a poster of Sukarno, the first president of Indonesia, nationalist hero, and then you got a poster of Adolf Hitler, and then you got a poster of the Beatles. And you could go down and you know, is it One Direction or Hitler? I don't know what I'm going to get today. Okay, I'll get the Hitler. And very little understanding of the history, but the image of strong man in uniform, commanding presence, and the knowledge that Hitler was a strong leader, has this circulation that is wild to people who are from other cultures that may have a different historical memory of that era. You see that this fascist imagery in all sorts of places in Indonesia. And that runs counter to sort of the what is generally a very refined and polite popular culture. The Indonesians use the word halus, and halus is sort of aristocratic, kind, gentle, welcoming. It's a Javanese value, and really contrasts that with kasar. And kasar is like sort of gruff popular, and politicians, Indonesian politicians, are always very, very halus and very sort of gentle and very diplomatic. But at the same time, there's this fascination with these figures of power, totally out of historical context, right.
And even but who are just convey strength and power and
And even even Sukarno, the left of center, very Communist Party friendly, first president of Indonesia, who had an ideology of NASCOM, nationalism, communism, and Islam. He was going to get those three together, and that was his state ideology. He adopted all sorts of fascist imagery. And there's a great anecdote in one of Benedict Anderson's works where he talks about being a translator at a cocktail party for diplomats in the 1960s. And Sukarno was saying, you know, it's good to be a nationalist. You know, look what Hitler did for Germany. You know, he went in there and fed all these Germans who felt really sad, and he made them feel good about themselves. And so I want to do that. And like Anderson's translating that for these diplomats, and they're just appalled at what this guy is saying. This is like 62, 63, maybe 64. And then the famous book, novel, and film title that we're not supposed to Indonesians aren't supposed to reference because it's such a cliche of the year of living dangerously. This was a speech Sukarno gave the year before he was overthrown, saying the Indonesian people, we're going to live dangerously, and we're going to, you know, it's sort of like Mao with, you know, bomb the bureaucratic ramparts kind of thing. That's lifted from Mussolini. He plagiarized Mussolini and Italian fascism on that year of living dangerously idea. So there's this current there that is across Indonesian politics. And so it's what makes this reinvention of Prabowo, who would be the epitome of that strongman. I mean, again, look at the old campaign photos with him on horseback. The invention of him as cuddly grandpa, stroke of genius. But I don't know. Hey, I'm not in his inner circle. Maybe he's gotten more paid. Maybe it's sincere. You know, maybe I'm just being paranoid here because
I do want to ask you.
Concerned. Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I do want to ask you whether this is, aesthetic, cultural, or if there is some kind of deeper, truer political reality that these images speak to. But before we get on to that, because we'll do that in just a little bit, I did wanted to ask what his, what his rule will be like. Just having a look a little bit at what some foreign press said. So the Financial Times suggested there might be concerns about populism, but by that they just mean some costly campaign pledges. Also, possibly his nationalism might put off Chinese investors. The Foreign Affairs said that Indonesia's democracy is stronger than a strong man, so Prabowo will find it difficult to rule as an authoritarian. Do you think those takes are correct? I mean, how do you see it? And also, how strong is he in the legislature?
Yeah. No, I mean, some of those takes are across the spectrum there. And also, in the intro, you should throw the Guardian under the bus with the winter is coming reference.
Yes.
Yes. Technically, I think the Guardian was quoting Amnesty International Indonesia.
They were quoting somebody.
Yeah,
they were, but it's still really cringe. So I'm, I know. I won't miss an opportunity to kick the Guardian.
Fair enough, but it was a human rights organization. It was either Amnesty International or one of the local organizations. Well, we don't know, but his track record and his public statements over decades are openly hostile to democratic institutions. In an interview a number of years ago with Alan Nairn, he said, "Yeah, maybe Indonesia needs fascism. Maybe I should be a fascist. Maybe that is something I'll embrace." And this was an interview about 10 years ago. Based on his behavior in 2019, I think there's no reason to think that he's really modified too much. But this process of the president in Indonesia gaining more power and being more centralized has been going on in this last term under Jokowi. And Jokowi has done a number of things, making it much more easier to go after people criticizing the president or other elite politicians, restricting human rights. Jokowi went back on, he really stabbed the KPK, the anti-corruption organization, in the back. He really sort of, emasculated it. It's lost a lot of its power. So I think, if Propoo does start to centralize power, this isn't a huge rupture. I think this is continuing a trajectory that has been developing in Jokowi's second term, which for many of us who were, I'll admit, up until more recently than I'm comfortable admitting, I was still pretty optimistic about Jokowi being this reformer. This past 2 years have just been the opposite of that.
Let's get on to him, because you called him Indonesia's Obama, and it's also worth noting that his son is now the vice president to Prabowo, right? So there's something going on there. What would be the U.S. equivalent of that? It'd be like one of Obama's kids, like running, being like Trump's VP or something.
Or Hunter Biden. Maybe that's it. The Hunter Trump ticket. We could really do something in there.
Right. That would be cool.
That would be Society of the Spectacle right there. Okay. So two things going on. What has been Jokowi's trajectory, and then what's up with this wild alliance that we've seen in this election between Jokowi and Prabowo. So, I mean, Jokowi, his background was that he was the first national politician who was not from this old guard elite. And all the other leading political figures come out of Suharto era politics and have connections to Suharto's New Order, this dictatorship of 32 years that only collapsed in 1998. And Jokowi came from, modest middle-class background, a city in central Java. His family were furniture sellers, and he became the mayor of this town, Solo, also known as Surakarta, in central Java, and was a fairly popular mayor, and then ran for governor of Jakarta. And that's kind of a curious trajectory, because he's a local politician in central Java, and then he runs for the governor of the capital city a couple hours away. But in the past couple decades, the thinking was that being governor of Jakarta was a way to move on to the presidency. And he was a fairly effective governor of Jakarta, and he was famous for wearing flannel shirts and being a heavy metal fan. And sort of this uncorrupted man of the people, and he would do these on the spot visits where he would just show up in an area where there were some social issues and just talk to the average people and just hear the average people. And it's great, you know, it's great photo ops. And then he would, you know, motion towards some sort of policy that would help them out. And he went on this incredible political trajectory from mayor of this town in Central Java to governor of Jakarta. After one term there, he ran for president of Indonesia and won in 2014 against Prabowo. And it was a pretty bitter election. The 2019 election is even more bitter and even more polarizing. And Jokowi presents himself as, you know, not corrupted and not part of the old elite. And for much of his presidency, he's really good on not having these corruption scandals up until these past couple of years. Most of his corruption, like the two big corruption scandals, were both Metallica-based corruption, both heavy metal-based corruption, where he received a guitar from that had been played by Metallica, and as a personal gift, and the corruption agencies wants to know, you can't do that. That's a personal gift, and so he donated it to the people of Jakarta, and they put it into a special park, and that won him even more popularity. And then I think a Swedish diplomat gave him a box set of some very rare Metallica albums.
Well, wait till Metallica find out that he hasn't been paying for their songs or albums, you know, then that'll be a real scandal.
Well, he got on stage when they played. And you know, there's a lot to be said about Indonesia, heavy metal and politics. I was living in Central Java when Guns N' Roses played, and they came out to black stage with a spotlight on the guitarist who was playing Indonesia Raya, the Indonesian national anthem. And the audience just went crazy. And I didn't know this happened. The next day, I'm just going to the 7-Eleven and everyone's stopping me like, yeah, America, Guns N' Roses, thank you so much. And like hearts and minds through heavy metal there. But and Jokowi was a heavy metal fan. Like his big boost came from this local metal band called Slank. Supporting him, which I had recently was told it was kind of on a whim that they supported him, and that gave him this popular appeal. Anyway, Joey was this uncorruptible figure that was from the old order, and then had this really nasty election in 2019, where again Prabowo, you know, started riots. And you know, he was doing a January 6th kind of thing before it was cool, right? And Jokowi responded by bringing Prabowo into his administration and made him Minister of Defense, which has been a pattern in Indonesian politics. It's, a team of rivals kind of thing. But Jokowi had not done much of this in his first administration, but he did it. He did it in 2019. And that gave that created the opening for this rapprochement between these two. And over the course of this administration, the second administration of Jokowi, he and Prabowo have become closer and closer. And also it's worth noting that when he made Prabowo Minister of Defense, Prabowo then was able to visit the United States for the first time in, I think, about 20 years. The U.S. had refused to give him a visa because of Prabowo's human rights record. But when he was Minister of Defense, the Trump administration said, well, we got to let this guy in. And so that was his first visit to the U.S. in I think, 2020.
All right, yeah.
He wasn't even allowed to see his son graduate from college in, I think, 2012 in Massachusetts. I call Jokowi the Indonesian Obama because there was so much optimism that this outsider would come in and really change things. And especially by the second administration, not much has changed. And indeed, he's increasingly bought into the existing power structure and also acting in a more and more authoritarian way. And so as he gets closer to Prabowo, his defense minister, and we start to move towards the election, it's clear that Prabowo is going to run again. And there's two other presidential candidates, one from Jokowi's party, who's a very nice but totally forgettable guy from Central Java. And then another politician, Anis. And Anis has another one of these very, very quick upward political trajectories, like Jokowi. He's American educated. One of my friends was his professor at Northern Illinois University. Very sharp political scientist. And he became governor of Jakarta, but he got to that position by attacking Jokowi's, who had been Jokowi's secondhand man, a Chinese Indonesian politician who goes by the name Ahok. And when Jokowi was Jokowi was governor of Jakarta, Ahok was his vice governor. And when Jokowi left to run for president and then become president, Ahok became the governor of Jakarta. And here we start to see some identity politics come in. And Anis used Muslim identity politics to just as a shorthand there. I know that's we can unpack that for hours, right? I don't want everybody coming at me for that, but basically using Muslim identity politics to go after Ahok, who's ethnic Chinese and Christian. And it led to there was a cell phone video of Ahok giving a speech where he was saying something about an Islamic a verse from the Quran that it wasn't anything that controversial, but that clip was edited in a really amateurish way. I've watched it a zillion times. I don't know how anybody could be convinced that it wasn't edited. And to make it look like he was engaging in blasphemy. And that led to this mobilization against Ahok. And Anis really rode that to power and beat Ahok in the election. And then Ahok was found guilty of blasphemy and spent a couple of years in jail. And this is the end Ahok's political career.
That's a big transgression of norms then. Like that would be something that which would just rule you out everywhere in Indonesian politics or
a conviction of blasphemy
in Java or
that was a bit of a career ender there and spent a couple years in jail. And I think that the judge gave him more time in jail than the prosecutors were asking for. And it was really scandalous. Wow. And so Anis, this who's now governor of Jakarta, had been using that and continued to use these popular demonstrations in Jakarta. They were huge. I mean, just gigantic demonstrations on Friday after Friday prayers, and you know, hundreds of thousands of people dressed in white in these big demonstrations. And this was Jokowi's political ally that Anis took down, Ahok. And so Jokowi definitely going to make sure that Anis doesn't come to power because Anis is the three presidential candidates were Prabowo, Anis, and then Ganjar, the guy from Jokowi's party. And Jokowi decided he's going to put his thumb on the scale in favor of Prabowo. He turned his back on the candidate from his own party, who they kind of shot themselves in. Jokowi's party kind of shot themselves in the foot. The power broker for that party is Megawati Soekarnoputri, who in Megawati is the daughter of President Sukarno. She briefly served as president, but has receded from electoral politics to be the power broker, right? And last year she Gibran come out and oppose Indonesia hosting, allowing the Israeli soccer team for the FIFA Under 20 League come to Indonesia. They said, no, we're not going to allow the Israeli team to come. And that backfired tremendously and led to Ganjar's approval in the polls tanking because FIFA responded by saying, okay, you're not going to let a team come. We're not sending this tournament to Indonesia. And love of soccer more important than fanning the flames of anti-Israel political sentiment.
Right.
So she kind of tanked. She kind of tanks that candidate, and then it looked like Anis was going to be the candidate writing this sort of cultural politics, and so Jokowi puts his thumb on the scale in favor of Prabowo, and going so far as to share Jokowi's incredible popularity. Like, Jokowi's going to leave office with incredibly high approval ratings, so high that Jokowi a year or so ago was toying with the idea of a third term, which is banned by the Constitution. But he was floating the idea of maybe blowing through that and taking a third term, but realizing he couldn't get away with that, he struck this alliance with Prabowo and essentially gives him his oldest son, Jokowi's oldest son, Gibran, to run as the vice presidential candidate on Prabowo's ticket. So in this incredible musical chairs, these two enemies suddenly are aligned. And then to make it even more frustrating and shady, Jokowi's son was too young to run for president. You have to be 40 years old to run for president. And he turned 36 as this was unfolding. And so Jokowi started a court case and said, well, he's already mayor of Solo, this town that Jokowi had been mayor of. And that's enough sort of executive authority to make one qualified for president, right? So it's this very spurious legal argument. And so it goes before the court, and the judge rules in favor of taking his previous administrative work to make up for the fact that he's literally 4 years too young. Now, that judge was Jokowi's brother-in-law.
Right.
I mean,
it's all very shady. Yeah.
And this is all happening in the space of a few months. Nonetheless,
I mean, this is a nice.
The Jokowi effect, you know, raises Prabowo's popularity to the through the roof. I mean, we saw it in the poll. We had really good polling data for this election, really, really good polling data. And so yesterday he won with like 60% of the vote, which is just shocking. Many of us thought, okay, he'll get 48, 49, but there'll be no runoff election. He's the presumed president.
I mean, that bit just there is a nice illustration, I suppose, of what our previous guest in Indonesia told us about the degree to which the oligarchy is still very much in place and controls larger areas of the state. I wonder, one last question on the election. Was there a central issue that came up that was the kind of pivot of the election, or was it just very personalized? And if there was an issue, is there some programmatic issue that is going to be taken forward by Prabowo into the presidency? I mean, is there going to be something like to look forward to him making a big international splash or building something domestically or trying to be more egalitarian or less so or whatever? I mean, is there something that is to be expected, or is this really just sort of managing the kind of existing trajectory of the Indonesian economy?
The latter. The debates were really quite dull. There was not much policy difference. I was just essentially arguing who was going to be continuing Jokowi's policies of developmental politics. The one area where Prabowo was making a lot of noise was increasing nickel mining. And nickel is increasingly important for batteries for electric vehicles, right? Mm. And he pushing for increasing nickel mining, but starting to bring some of the value-added work into Indonesia, so processing the nickel, right? So you're less of a Saudi Arabia type situation, right, where you're just exporting. Get some of that work done there. And there's been negotiations with Tesla for a couple of years now to start making the batteries in Indonesia, and that would be huge in terms of doing the value added work in Indonesia. And that's the sort of developmental economic populism. I've been reading that the next generation of batteries are not going to be as dependent upon nickel. So this may not work out as planned.
Bad gamble, yeah.
But they're trying to, you know, increase the extractive industries, nickel, palm oil, you know, gold mines in New Guinea, increase the extractive industries, but start to do some, again, more value added work, in order to, you know, build the economy. But right. Amongst the candidates, there's really not that much of a difference in policies.
And they're signed up. I mean, and Prabowo signed up to this idea of a new capital in Borneo, which I always find, you know, setting up a new capital a fascinating thing, often very problematic and contradictory and riven with various problems. But it is always a mark of kind of modernist ambition, whether you consider Brasilia being built in the 50s in Brazil or Equatorial Guinea in Africa is building a whole new capital with their oil money deep in the interior. And Indonesia is doing the same. It's kind of leaving Jakarta behind, at least as a capital, and trying to set up its new one in Borneo. I find that story fascinating. I don't know if you have any story or insight to share about that, but I find it it's something that will, I guess, at least keep Indonesia in the headlines insofar as it's such a, yeah, it's such an ambitious move.
Yeah, it's an ambitious move, and it ties a bunch of things together. I mean, it at the core of this this policy is facing the realities of climate change and the fact that northern Jakarta is literally sinking into the Java Sea, is partially due to centuries of building on an old colonial city and also with climate change and the drainage systems have gotten messed up. Have you ever been in Jakarta during a rainstorm? I mean, in the space of 2-3 hours, whole neighborhoods can find themselves underwater and your sections of the city just shut down. I have some sort of strange masochism because I absolutely love Jakarta as a city. Absolutely love it. But the traffic jams that you get in there. Well, you live in Sao Paulo. I mean, it's
we don't get whole neighborhoods flooded, but we get quite a bit of flooding. I mean, it might not be up to your neck, but you get up to your waist. You know?
The famous traffic jams, right? That can occur at all hours of the day. So in many ways, Jakarta is becoming not a functional urban center. It's falling apart, and so this idea to move the capital to Borneo, which was a bit of a surprise, and seems to be moving forward. And in the past year or so, it has drawn the eyes of corruption watchdogs, and surprise, surprise, there's some deals going on there. I've seen various mock-ups of what the new capital will be like. Last summer I was up in Makassar, just across the strait from Borneo, where the capital is going to go in. It's a long ways from Java. The model is Brasilia, is this administrative center that will be at some distance from the economic hub of Jakarta. I don't know. We'll see. I wouldn't be entirely surprised if in 5 years it just never comes to be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I wish them the best. it will be a wild restructuring of Indonesia, and will lead to some development in the north and some real economic boom in Kalimantan, which is Indonesian Borneo, and also in the Moluccas and in that northern part of Indonesia, which is, you know, a stunningly gorgeous place, also very resource rich. Borneo is the site of incredible deforestation right now, as palm oil plantations are going in and mm-hmm. absolutely devastating ecological damage, which is something I think that the Prabowo administration will dramatically increase, because in addition to mining, there's expansion of palm oil plantation is on his agenda. But I don't know. The whole new capital project could possibly collapse, but seems to be moving forward.
That's fascinating. Maybe something that we at BungaCast need to do a dedicated episode on. to kind of move down to the last bit I wanted to talk about, as a regular listener to this podcast will know, I mean, there's the concept of the end of history also implies a disconnection from the past and indeed from historical memory. And that is a global experience. There might be some exceptions to it, but by and large, that has been the experience of the end of the Cold War. What's amazing about Indonesia, certainly along the lines of what you were telling me, but just before we started recording, is that Indonesia is kind of the end of history well before that. I mean, with the massacres of 65 and then 66, and continues until today. Like, history is a non-topic. It's an anti-history country. So tell me what an anti-history country is like.
Yeah, and I say this as someone who, you know, as a profession, does history of Indonesia and has taught history in Indonesia. I taught at Gajah Mada, which is one of the top three universities in the country. Some absolutely brilliant students there, and very, very spotty historical knowledge. And these are amongst these elite students. And for the general population, the man and woman on the street, very, very poor command of recent Indonesian history. And that's due to the Suharto era education system, which just either glossed over political developments really since World War II, or presented just a complete New Order narrative that was deeply, deeply, deeply rooted in this anti-communist narrative. And so, I mean, just to review, in 1965, the popular left-wing President Sukarno was friendly with the Indonesian Communist Party, which is, you know, famously the largest communist party outside of the Soviet Union or the People's Republic of China at the time. And there was a coup, and it got blamed on the Communist Party. And the Indonesian military used that coup as a pretext to eliminate the Indonesian Communist Party. I mean, 500,000 to 1,000,000. One of the genocidaires claimed it was maybe 3 million people are killed in the space of about a year. A lot of it by hand. You know, the Joshua Oppenheimer films have brought that to international attention, right? And then the General Suharto slides into power in this creeping coup. He takes about a year to get himself installed, but he's fully in charge, and Sukarno is moved aside. That story of there was a communist threat and General Suharto stepped in and had to remove it is really the one historical fact that everyone knows, and this idea that the communists were about to take over. And the fact is there wasn't a communist takeover. There was no communist army. But the Suharto regime for 32 years built this massive propaganda state. And I think it's probably one of the most successful propaganda efforts of the 20th century. As an undergraduate, I was a student of Peter Knez, who wrote Birth of the Propaganda State about the Soviet Union in the 20s and 30s. And I think it's vastly more successful there because they did things like make a 4.5-hour documentary, or not documentary, a drama about the night of the coup d'etat, which presents the communists as like evil witches. And it's really misogynistic, and it has this really graphic, bloody scenes of when the generals are killed. And every year that was shown on national television, and school children were marched down to see it in theaters. I've got friends my age and a little bit younger who in elementary school and high school had to go watch this movie every year on the anniversary of the murder of these generals that was the pretext for the slaughter of the Indonesian Communist Party. And you talk to people, and that's the narrative they know. Now, numerous scholars, Indonesian and international scholars, have shown like that narrative is completely false. But the Suharto regime was so successful at instilling that narrative that it's really impossible to question that. Like, people would look at you like you're from Mars. And you have, in every city, you have streets named after these six generals that were killed. that were the pretext for this mass murder. You have a major museum. It's called the Museum of the Treachery of the Indonesian Communist Party, which after Suharto and especially after the Cold War, and then after Suharto, I kind of thought would close up. That they keep adding on to that museum. it's getting bigger.
So this is a question. I wonder, like, is this an ongoing project of remembering this false narrative, or is it a project of kind of forgetting the past and not really having any sense of historical continuity? Because those two things maybe are, you know, stand against each other. I don't know.
Well, I think that when you are faced with this project of this narrative being crammed down your throat, it creates apathy in historical interest, and it doesn't create historical thinking, historical engagement, and it's, you know, it can be very dangerous, like physically dangerous, to question this the New Order narrative. Up to the present. And there's been these moments where, you know, things like, some of it's international, some of it, much of it is organic from Indonesia, where you have artists or intellectuals or films like the Joshua and Oppenheimer films challenging the Suharto era narrative in the post Suharto era. And there's these moments where, oh, there's going to be a little light opening, and they keep getting crushed and they keep getting slammed down. And it's just very dangerous to do this. So screenings of The Act of Killing would get disrupted by Pemuda Pancasila. You know, Joshua Oppenheimer responded by doing a free download as long as you were using an IP address in Indonesia. So we distributed the film that way. So I think it can be both. I think it can be both. The successful propaganda
machine.
Because,
I guess it's not a given that you would necessarily try to, you know, perpetuate this narrative. It's very easy as an ongoing thing, like the communists are still a threat, we must clamp down on any mention of this, because it'd be easy for them to also just, you know, make a break at 1998 and say, well, yeah, bad things happened back then. Now we're a democracy. Now we're good. So, you know, you can, yes, you can be aware of these bad things that were done, but that was back then. That was the previous regime. This has nothing to do with us, which is what many kind of post-authoritarian then regimes that become democracies sometime around the 1980s and 1990s do. You know, they kind of kick all the bad stuff into the past and wash their hands of it. And it's interesting that Indonesia hasn't pursued this path. It's pursued a path of sustaining a kind of very active engagement with its history, with sustaining a narrative, you know, even if it's a completely false one.
Well, this has so much to do with the fact that Suharto falls and there is no de-Suhartoization. The bureaucracy that he created survives his fall. The business cronies that benefited under the New Order regime are literally 25 years, some of the same people in power or same families in power. And the army, while there's been a bit of a return to the barracks, it hasn't been a complete return to the barracks. They don't have a percentage of parliament like they used to. But the people that benefited from the New Order, which is complicit not just in the bloodbath that brought Suharto to power, but also the occupation of Western New Guinea, Irian Jaya, Papua, which is ongoing and a site of gross human rights abuses, where a place where the incoming president served, but also the invasion of East Timor, which by any accounts was a genocidal occupation by Indonesia from 1975 to 1998. Something like a third of the population of East Timor was killed in that time period. I think it is a loss of life that we haven't seen in the world since the Nazi regime in like occupation of Latvia and the Baltic countries, I think is where it comes up to. And Aceh, the ongoing civil war in Aceh, which has come to an end, but it was a decades long civil war with gross human rights abuses there. So many of the actors who carried out the Suharto era policies who engaged in the repression, who benefited from this, because there's a lot of money to be made, and owe their careers and their family's career, family's well-being to complicity in the Suharto regime, that can't be discussed. And there's real anxiety amongst the elites that if you probe too deeply into this past, people will want revenge. So the survivors of 65 are getting very, very senior now, and there's very few around, but there's anxiety that their families will want revenge. Mm-hmm. And there's no state memorial to the victims of 65, 66, even though Suharto is long gone. There's only one place in Bali, and I met with these the folks who run it last summer, Taman 65, Park 65, and it's their private residence, which they've set up as a space memorializing their father who was killed in the anti-communist bloodshed, and they hold public events there. And they're under constant pressure from the authorities, from civil actors, from their neighbors. And it's very, very difficult to talk about these abuses in the Suharto era, because so many people are complicit, and it's a threat to them. It's a threat to the whole, to their well-being.
No, that's fascinating. Fascinating how that can be ongoing. But as you say, I guess the idea that there was Indonesia was fighting wars on several different fronts, kind of at its borders for a long time, sustained a much more traditional Cold War right wing regime attitude, where in many other places that kind of lapsed into a much more kind of neoliberal end of history, kind of we can forget everything, nothing really matters sort of attitude.
Yeah, and in those ongoing campaigns, and these are wars, I mean, they're not, I mean, it's at the borders, but it's in Indonesian territory. These are domestic, you know, wars.
Yeah,
You know, most international human rights observers would say New Guinea is occupied, but technically these are all part of the Indonesian nation state. And you have major political actors like the incoming president, Prabowo, who served in East Timor, who served in right. In New Guinea, who has connections to there's a number of Timorese that worked with the Indonesians, and then when East Timor voted for independence, many of them left and came to Jakarta, where they worked as preman, worked as thugs. And Prabowo's got direct connections to some of these. Hercules, this guy Hercules, who's just like this terrifying gangster guy. He lost his eye in the war, and he always wears a black glove. I think he had some damage there. And he used to run one of the major gangs in Jakarta down at Tanah Abang. He's like been very open that he pledges his loyalty to Prabowo, and that they've got direct connections there. And this was as a youth, he was orphaned when the Indonesian army killed his family, and Indonesian officers basically adopted him, this sort of battlefield adoption. So these connections to these ongoing wars that are really brutal. I mean, really, really brutal. And it builds a real esprit de corps amongst the officers and the rank and file soldiers. For example, one of the major groups in these military efforts is Kopassus, which is the Indonesian Special Forces, of which Prabowo headed. He was the head of the Special Forces, they're really the elite of the New Order era, and they continue to be the elite of the Indonesian military. And when I was living in Yogyakarta in Central Java in 2013, there was a bar fight one night. I wasn't there. it was a bar. It was like by the airport. Everyone in there, but I think it was adjacent to a hotel. It was called Hugo's, and a bar fight broke out. I think it was over a drug deal, and it was a bar fight between police officers and members of Kopassus. And a member of Kopassus was killed by an off-duty police officer. And the guy who the suspect was arrested, he was put in jail, And he was put in jail. He was being held for a couple of days outside of the city of Yogyakarta in this jail that I'd ride my motorcycle past every now and then. Very spooky place. And a couple of days into his detention, a bunch of black SUVs pull up with guys in full Bruce Willis, Arnold Schwarzenegger style commando outfits with communication systems. They use explosives, blow open the door of the jail, and go through and find the suspect and murder them in the cell. And then leave.
Wow.
And, you know, this is in the town I'm living in. This is a mile or two from where I live. Everyone's appalled. Everyone knows it was Kapasus. It was these special forces guys. Finally, the head of the military steps forward and says, all right, everybody knows this was the special forces did this. You know, we've identified who they are. We've detained them. The situation was that the guy that was killed in the bar fight was their commanding officer in operations, and they had a lot of loyalty, and that's something that we really praise in the Indonesian army. So we're going to just handle this ourselves, and there's nothing to see here. Don't worry about it.
Right.
So they can engage in these extrajudicial killings against the police force. And there's this ongoing, this could be a whole nother podcast, but there's an ongoing history of tension between the Indonesian police force and the Indonesian army. Because during the Suharto era, the army assumed so many functions in society that the police really didn't do much. And as part of the return to the barracks under democratization, the TNI, the army, is supposed to pull back, but hasn't really been pulling back. And there's a number of incidents over the years like this that happened in Yogyakarta with this prison raid, or with army and police units fighting each other and like using rocket-propelled grenades to blow up a police station because they're in a dispute over black market petroleum sales.
Fascinating. I need to ask you, you know, for the outro to this episode, for some Indonesian heavy metal, because I think that would be like really fitting there to illustrate what you were just talking about. But Mike, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.